Mr. Defebri.
I don't like the sound.
Senator Dill, did you say that you hired someone who was in the Montana State Pen for stealing salad?
I think he said saddle.
For stealing saddles.
Okay. Thank you very much. My hearing was...
I can tell that's really been bugging you for the last hour, hasn't it? As he eats a carrot.
I thought that man must have done really hard time.
Well, they got three strikes and you're out in Montana and then some. Yeah.
Easier to stop eating salads than it is to stop drinking, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification for posterity on tape.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, what I would like to do very briefly, believe it or not, very briefly is to have Mr. Defebri discuss the process that we're going to be engaging in with the Federal Department of Energy regarding our plan and its implementation. I think it might inform your discussions about the provisions and the flexibility and some of these other issues we brought up. And I wanted to emphasize that I wanted to dispel the impression I think I may have given the committee that this was a one-time thing. We had a plan, we would submit it on the 12th, and then that's the end of it. In fact, it's a much more iterative process than I may have led folks to believe. So I'd like, if it pleases the committee, I'd like to have Mr. Defebri go through a brief discussion of the process.
All right, Mr. Defebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy Defebri, and I am with the Office of Energy Security in the Department of Commerce. In particular, I would like to highlight the process for the State Energy Program funds, because that is probably the one that is, as Mr. Glahn said, a more iterative process and presents some implementation problems and timing problems with how we go about this. We have submitted, as you know, our preliminary application, which was due in March. The feds have cut our grant for the SEP ARRA funds and released the first 10% of those funds for planning and ramp-up purposes. We are submitting a more detailed plan on May 12th, next Tuesday. That is our intention, is that be fully informed by the final product of this conference committee. Upon review and approval of that plan, the feds will release the next 40% of the SEP funds. There is no defined release of the remainder of the funds within SEP guidance right now. It is based on performance. We have to meet at certain points at yet undefined our metrics. We have to have a certain amount of obligation and expenditures, and in looking at the types of projects that we need to implement, we need to keep in mind that in order to get to the full $54 million that you're appropriating, we have to meet a performance requirement. It's not they don't release the full 100%, and then at the end of the period they say, did you fully implement and meet your metrics for that $54 million? I believe, are going to need some capacity to say, these are the programs we need to push hard and dedicate more funds to early in the process so that we know we can get our metrics met and get the release of the second funds, the last phase of funds. So that's a consideration that I think hasn't been brought up in any of our other discussions, that we do need to look at among the other types of flexibility that we need. Flexibility in timing.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Sure. What you were.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments?
Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, what we'd like to do next is to go through, to the extent the side-by-side allows us to do so, to go through the two bills and give you very specific comments on the language. Ms. Streff and Mr. Defebri will do that, and I anticipate chiming in as well. where I have particular views on some of these items, as well as, I hope, respond in a constructive manner to some of the very good questions brought up by members of the committee and some of the earlier testifiers today.
All right, thank you. So, Ms. Streff, you're going to start us off here?
Sure. The first comments that we have are on page R4, unless you gentlemen have other comments. I guess I will say that this will most likely be a back-and-forth effort. We have certainly been a team so far, and we'll continue to do that. All right. As you have obviously heard, Mr. DeFebri has no problem speaking his mind.
Imagine Ms. Streff having him as a constituent.
We have gone through the language for both bills and did work some with the House at the time they were passing theirs and did get some areas changed. So some of the comments we have on the Senate bill are just because we did not have the opportunity to do that. For instance, on page R4, 2.15, we would agree that it should be existing providers of weatherization services rather than past, because we're still working with them. Yes. Also on 2.27, 2.26 through 2.28, our renewable energy equipment program that was put into effect a year or so ago actually uses the weatherization eligibility as the eligible requirements for its program. So it's already there, so I don't know that we need that language in there since it already exists.
So, Ms. Streff, if I could just jump in here. Mm-hmm. So, it's already eligible through your procedures or rules, not through statute, I assume. I mean,
not through statute. It requires us to have a renewable energy renewable energy equipment program. It uses, however, money for low income activities, and so it's through our weatherization program, and we do use the existing weatherization eligibility.
Okay, so I'm not quite understanding what it is that you already have a program to do this with. Other dollars that you already have, or that it would also make these dollars eligible for that use?
Madam Chair, actually, we do have a renewable energy equipment grant program that is funded through a state appropriation. It is statutory, and I can't remember the site, but it was a bill that Representative Saylor sponsored on the House side last year, and it utilizes some of the petroleum product tax that comes to the state on each gallon of product that gets dispensed. In that statute, it says it is intended for those people that are eligible for weatherization assistance funds. So it does direct it towards this clientele, but it is a state funded program. So we don't know that this language is really necessary within the context of this.
But is there enough money in that fund? I mean, would it make sense to expand eligibility to the other weatherization dollars or not?
Madam Chair, the federal government has specific requirements for eligibility for renewable projects, and it is pretty restrictive. If you were to say it's eligible, it becomes redundant because the feds already say it's eligible and we're operating under their rules. But the reality is that it's very difficult for us to do renewables under their rules.
Representative Champion?
I think this might be the place. Did you have an opportunity, Mr. Freeby, to hear my question earlier about the weatherization issue? Or do you want me to just say it again?
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, I believe if you're talking about the pass down of all regulations, all requirements and compliance with law and rule to the local agencies and to their subcontractors, is that?
That's my question.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, all of those requirements are put into the contracts that we have with our community action agencies. So the requirements for inclusion are also required by them.
And so is there anything that we should do, whether we accept the Senate or House language, whichever the committee decides, that would make sure that there's a clear understanding? Because I did talk to some of the community action agencies who were not very sure or clear if inclusion language was very clear to them, especially in light of this language that says past providers must be used to their full extent, yada, yada, yada. And so is there any documentation that you have with, let's say, your local community action agency that would spell that out, or should we try to spell that out in the bill here?
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, we do include it in their contract language each year. It sounds as though we should highlight it, and we are more than willing to do that. But I don't think it needs to be in the language, since it is required by the federal laws, and we send those federal laws through us down to our community action agencies.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Champion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
To this page, I noticed, Mr. Feber, you skipped over the shelters language on 220 to 2.23. And if you could just, it's new language to us in the House, and I'm wondering if you could comment on eligibility and how it would work.
Ms. Strapp. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, 1040 CFR, Chapter 420, I believe, Section 440, does require us or allows shelters to be part of the weatherization. To date, I don't think there have been many done, but we've already been talking to the weatherization agencies about that possibility. In addition, rental units have always been a part and allowed by the weatherization rules. And our CAP agencies have worked with landlords. We have a policy, although it's not a requirement, that they work with their landlords to see if they can get them to not raise the rent on their tenants for the next year. That's met with some resistance. And so I do think some of the work on rental units has not been as high as it could be. In the ERA language this time, there was explicit language in the ERA law to relax the rules as much as possible, or the policies as much as possible, on rental units. And so we are certainly working with our weatherization agencies to make sure that they try and work with the landlords as much as possible. As Mr. Anderson had testified earlier, we've been working with MHFA to see what larger multifamily units, rental units, may be available to be weatherizing those. And that work has already started to see which ones across the whole state are available to be done.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
I was very skeptical about that shelters language, and turns out that in terms of giving credit where credit is due, that was a very fine move, it sounds like, on your part, and want to thank you for including it, because I was concerned it would not all be eligible, but it sounds like Congress, in its actual wisdom, not infinite wisdom, actually did the right thing there, and I guess it wouldn't be Congress, it would be DOE in this case, since it's CFR, but thank you for doing that.
Yeah, the Salvation Army had brought this to our attention and said they may have some facilities that would be interested. It made sense to include it if we could.
And, you know, Madam Chair, not to drag this out too much, but I think I made a comment about the fact that Health and Human Services conference meeting now and making cuts that I think a lot of us are glad we're not at the table having to make, but we'll have to vote on them. And this is a human service addition that we can make in any small way to make sure that those shelters are open. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, go ahead, please.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to just respond to the testimony regarding the 200% of federal poverty level. And we have been looking at how we can do that in our office since the language came out. We believe we found a workaround to be able to calculate it, and we're starting to work on that, but it's not a sure thing. We believe that it makes sense to go to 200%. The LIHEAP program at this point is the 50% of state median income, the 180 or 185%. So we have been using their eligibility. So this is a step in a different direction for us. And we want to make sure that we are making that, that we're getting the right information. I am not sure that we will be able to make that change effective as soon as we get the money to start production, but we have not been slow or tardy on it at all. We've already been working to see how we might do that and get the software changed.
I'm just going to stop for a second. Representative Saylor, unfortunately, while you were out of the room, we had a discussion about the solar heat program. And basically, I think if I can paraphrase the testimony really quick, they said there's already the program that you passed into law that has a source of funding for this, and the question is whether it would be eligible under the federal rules for – they use the same income eligibility as weatherization, but it's not strictly weatherization eligibility. I think if I got the gist of this right.
Madam Chair, we essentially.
That was quite a look on your face. I think I didn't quite say it right.
It's dangerous to paraphrase Mr. DeFebri, I've learned.
We are under the program that was created under Representative Saylor's authorship. The state funds are used in households that meet the eligibility requirement for the weatherization program. So, in practice, it is been delivered through our CAP agencies to those that are moving through their program for weatherization.
Okay, but I thought I got the sense you didn't think we should put this in here.
Madam Chair, I don't know that it
neutral.
I don't know that it serves any additional purpose to put it in there. We have the statutory requirement to deliver that with the state funds. The feds allow us theoretically to use their funds for renewables, but in fact their requirements for qualification and return on investment make it almost impossible to do it. We are examining how the per house average, which is significantly higher under new legislation, $6,500 per house rather than $3,000 approximately, how that language affects what was language relative to averages on renewables. But we don't have answers on that yet.
Thank you. All right. Please continue.
Madam Chair, on perhaps a little clarification on intent on R4, Senate side 3-1 to 3-3. In stating that we must use a variety of strategies to fund weatherization, we're not clear whether the intent is to try and create some sort of multi-level types of assistance that are offered, or whether it's more on the various strategies to reach weatherization clients.
Well, Mr. DeFebri, again, this is a little bit of a drafting question, but I think If you look on page R6, you'll see the same sentence with the follow-up that should be attached to it. That is where we outline neighborhood saturation and the quick fix as two of those possible strategies, as well as the following language about loans and rebates, and that was really what that reference was supposed to be attached to. And so I think maybe it just got moved for some reason. So, or this is the weatherization. Well, it's weatherization, not other residential. So I don't know what we meant. I hate to admit it.
We often have the same problem. It appears that it somewhat repeats language on R6, 4.1 to 4.4, and maybe striking the 3.1 to 3.3 on R4 and taking the 4.1 to 4.4 on R6 accomplishes your purpose.
Yeah. I think that's really what the intent of this was. So. Because it is repeated twice, and I think it sort of accidentally appeared in two places, and it wasn't supposed to.
Further address, just clarify.
Okay. Same language here. Okay. And then it actually explains it.
It's got in here twice.
This is just leftover. Took off the quick fix and all that. Yeah, I think that was a leftover phrase that wasn't supposed to be there. So, not a problem.
I usually like leftovers, but in this case,
especially with salad.
With salads, yes, purloined salads. R5. 3.4. This again, I think, is an artifact of having moved some of the language relative to neighborhood saturation efforts to a different area. If we just strike the 3.4, 3.5 language related to further addressing neighborhood saturation.
So, in terms of the foreclosure waiver, do you have any issue with that?
None whatsoever, no. And given the indications that Mr. Anderson said on the agreement between HUD and DOE on public housing, sort of a categorical qualification, that we're reasonably hopeful that DOE and HUD can come to some sort of agreement on this kind of thing, too.
Madam Chair, we've already talked with the U.S. Department of Energy weatherization staff and explained your interest and explained how difficult it's been in the Neighborhood Stabilization Program to want to use some weatherization dollars but not knowing who may be coming into it. And they have even expressed some possible attitude that if they do know that some low-income family will be purchasing that house, that money from the weatherization program could be used in addition to it. So we're working with them, and we don't have any problem applying for the waiver.
Great. That's just what we were hoping for. Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, it still is not clear to me how this can work. I mean, beyond a problem, I think there is a problem certainly with the language in this section. And line 14, 3.14, provided the home becomes occupied. I mean, it seems to me that we have to be able to identify some commitment in advance. We can't say we're going to do this and then something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something has to happen first. I'm totally in sympathy with the intent here, but I'm having a very difficult time envisioning how this can happen without ending up not benefiting any of the intended recipients.
Representative Hilty, I might suggest that we could take out that phrase because it is kind of awkward and subject to interpretation, and just leave the directive to apply for the waiver. I mean, obviously, that's how this would actually occur is something that would have to be worked out and very
carefully. But I think it can be done. I mean, we heard testimony about Habitat for Humanity homes being using weatherization dollars where you've identified someone who, you know, has signed on the dotted line, I'm going to move into this house. And in Habitat's model, they put in sweat equity hours. I mean, they have a whole process where they identify the owner long before, sometimes before the house is built and or before it's renovated, and then they could use the dollars in a situation like that. But I don't know that we need to micromanage the details. We just want the concept out there.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you need to find some language that makes that clear, because otherwise what we could end up doing is simply putting money into a property that was still owned by Wells Fargo or whoever and didn't really have the benefit that you're describing.
Okay. So that's your concern, is to make sure that it's going to become owner-occupied and that it is going to become occupied by an owner who is income-eligible.
Can I make a suggestion?
That's what this is intended to say, but perhaps it could be said more artfully. I'm not sure what the solution is to what your question is.
Madam Chair, you know that one of the things that is occurring with properties such as this is that they're being bought basically by speculators.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think that our intent here is to advantage them in any way.
Well, or to use our scarce federal weatherization dollars to help them make a buck. Absolutely. That's not the point. And so, Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, I think a couple of points relative to Representative Hilty's concerns. One is that neighborhood stabilization program, those homes that participate in that would already have been acquired by a nonprofit rehabilitation organization or by a city. So it would not still be a bank-held home. As far as determining that there is a reasonable likelihood and that it will be occupied by an eligible householder after it's rehabbed, I think the feds are not going to grant us a waiver without some fairly strong indication that somebody is locked into a requirement that they only sell to somebody that would be income qualified.
Well, if you could help us with further refining this language, that would be great. And do you have any idea how long this waiver process might take?
Madam Chair, the feds are somewhat occupied right now.
Anybody's guess?
It would be tough to guess.
Sure. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, on the house language side of R5, we just wanted to reiterate on lines 3.11 that we too had questioned the requirement for having the individual pay for the background check, as well as the employment prohibition in lines 3.16 to 3.18.
You know, Madam Chair?
Representative Kalin.
One of the questions I raised on the House floor is whether, as written, this would endanger federal funds at all. And knowing that we're going to try to find some way of having a reasonable background check here, will any background check requirement for, let's say, for all $197 million of our pie do anything to put at risk the funds?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Gray testified, their background checks are often a practice at CAP agencies already utilizing federal funds. So I don't see any cause to worry that it might, you know, cause problems with other federal funding. It can be more a question of this is drawn solely to weatherization, and it might be far more difficult to try and apply it more broadly to some of the other SEP programs.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeFebvre, because of the multitude of contracts and grants and administrative procedure, is that the issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Kale, and many of those, there are going to be multiple contractual relationships, many of them passing through a number of entities. For instance, residential financing is through us to MHFA, through a lender down to an individual who is engaging contractors on their own. That, for instance, is one where there would be no way to reach through. There are enough problems with that. That many layers already. Some of the other ones relative to solar rebates or small rebates are again getting into very small actions, and it would add a burden that probably would not have a return.
We won't be doing solar rebates, Mr. Feeb, or we won't be doing background checks on recipients of solar rebates. Is that essentially the point?
Or background checks on the contractors who those solar rebate recipients choose of their own free will.
Okay.
Go ahead, please.
On page R6 on the Senate side, line 3.20, we would insert, and the Department of Commerce, after the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on 3.20. And then, so we would say that the MHFA and the Department of Commerce shall jointly develop, and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency shall implement. This was, however, somewhat before the discussion this morning about the transfer of money and how much to MHFA and who, what other kinds of programs may exist. And I guess I would like to report that we've also been working and meeting with the Builders Association of Minnesota and the Minnesota Certified Green Star, Minnesota Green Star Certified program for remodeling of homes, and they expressed concern or interest or that there was a market for the market rate folks who could access a loan and who might be very interested in with some sort of rebate or incentive to do a great deal of energy efficiency work. They've been talking with people and think there is a market in that section of the residential. So I guess we would be in favor of having funding for more than one area of the market.
So you mean loans, rebates, grants, all of the possibilities?
Possibilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we're in agreement on that. Yeah. Representative Kalin.
Madam Chair, Ms. Streff. Am I hearing that you prefer the House language that you wrote?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, the House language would work very well.
Ms. Streff, are there portions of the Senate language, for instance, 327 to 335, that would be useful at all? I mean, it's included but not limited to, but are there other pieces that you'd recommend adding? I see Director Glahn.
Madam Chair, Representative Kamel, before we jump down any farther, I didn't want to try and do this in order. The 3.18, I heard the discussion earlier today around the word transfer, and just sitting in the back of the room thinking my common sense English language, plain language view of that, a transfer would involve a change of custody. So it seems like the way the 3.18 would be written, and perhaps we have other budget experts in here who would contradict me, but you'd say we take this money and we transfer it to another agency, it's kind of out of our hands. And that, so I guess that was behind my thinking behind why we would like to have our group written into the language as it is on the House side. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I think simply by striking that first partial sentence on 3.18 and 3.19, by telling us that we need to develop a program and have the Housing Finance Agency implement it, it tells us that we have to essentially enter into an interagency agreement to fund that program for them. So you have to appropriate the funds to us because we are the federal grantee for SEP.
You know, we spent a lot of time talking about this. I think we're all in agreement here.
Yep. Okay, great.
I don't think we need to belabor the point. Yeah,
the House had it right.
I think it was an error, that first phrase. Well, I still like some of the other Senate language. But you can have your fun, Jeremy.
with respect to Representative Kalin's question about the enumeration of measures in the Senate, and included but not limited to, one finds it often, but what exactly does it do?
Well, I think the point has been made, maybe not today, that we want, number one, we need accountability here, and it's not a lack of trust. We really respect the work that you all do, but we need to be very clear about what the outcomes are that we expect from this money, and that's all we're talking about. We don't want it, as has been said before, to be used to paint somebody's house. So we just want to be clear, this is only for energy efficiency improvements, and you can say that's stating the obvious, but to those who read bills, you know, it's important to lay out the basic principles that we're hoping to accomplish here. And that's all it is. It's not really any kind of secret strategy beyond that.
No. Madam Chair, I think to affect that end, merely if you said...
Beyond the obvious.
To affect that end, if you merely said that it was for the purpose of energy efficiency improvements rather than going through an enumeration that doesn't really limit within that language. It's
yes. Well, there are some, obviously, you've probably heard, there are some people who would like to emphasize some things lest they be forgotten. Windows would be an example, because they might not show up on a list of some people's recommended energy improvements. But as a legislature, we've had a lot of conversation about how we think it's important for public policy for Minnesota to elevate the level, the importance of window replacement, even if they might not be the most cost-effective energy efficiency improvement. So that's why we write bills, so that we can express our point of view about these things. And so that's all we're trying to do, is express our preferences and our priorities, and we don't want them to be obstacles. So hopefully we can work within those goals that we share to have flexibility, but also prioritize.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, the language does not create any impediments for us, so it's merely I have a bias towards an economy of words.
I certainly understand that.
However, there is an issue with language on 325 to 327. We do not, a couple of things. One, we do not certify energy auditors. Mm-hmm. So there would be no one that would meet that qualification. As I believe others have noted, there is a concern that the requirement for an energy auditor may be also an impediment to moving the program forward as expeditiously as we want. There is also, to your point of wanting particularly to promote window replacements and those sorts of things, I probably should keep, you know, we are less enthused by that, but I should point out that would probably be an impediment for us to actually do those, because an energy auditor's report likely would not be recommending mm-hmm. window replacement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeFeeb, on the housing finance language, it's unclear to me. You don't anticipate actually the Housing Finance Agency getting the money and putting it in their fund? Because the language says you should sort of coordinate. That's unusual. Is it the intent of the House to send the money to Housing Finance Agency or not?
Mr. Fuller, Mr. Fieber, I believe that that our understanding that we had reached together was that we would use the stimulus funds as a leverage separate from the MHFA funds, but coordinated and kind of integrated with, so that there wouldn't be a transfer. It would be OES's discretion to work out with MHFA how best to make those programs work together.
Mr.
Fuller.
Representative Cancel, how is that intended?
Not answering your question.
No. We have to put the bill together. So the money stays with OES, but then OES gives some money to HFFA that they can then do gap work with? Or I'm only asking because I just read your bill. I thought it was going to MHFA, and that was the sense I got from their representative because it was going to be transferred. So I'm wondering how this mechanism works so MFHA will know they have a certain amount of money to do certain things. I mean, what is the role of MHFA then if the money is controlled by OES?
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, our intention would be within an interagency agreement to commit X number of dollars to MHFA for these program purposes. However, we're on a system with the feds where we do essentially a draw as funds are needed. They have a very tight cash management requirement. And we could not draw funds that would not be utilized by MFHA within the next 3 days out of the federal system. So we're not going to move a pot of money there. We are going to have an obligation to fund that.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, we can talk about it later, but I think that if you have a program that MFHA is going to market, I see their spokesperson here, that if you're drawing it down in a sense as it's needed, that seems not efficient. So maybe I'm just not understanding. Maybe Jeanette has. Is it Jeanette?
Yeah, Ms. Blankenship.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, we understand the federal guidelines as far as we're not going to be able to get money up front, but we also, when working with our lender network, we purchase the loans, and the lenders front the money. So we would be able to know when the loan is going to be closed, let Office of Energy Security know. They would have to do a transfer through us so that we can get that money once we buy the loan back from the lender. So it would work. There would be some. The money would not likely go directly from OES to the lender. So at some point it would come through us, but it wouldn't be fronted to us.
And to do this type of agreement, you don't need any legislative authorization?
No, Madam Chair.
Or interagency transfers of funds?
I trust them.
Madam Chair, we have in our...
Thank you.
In our policy notes, we've included this as a possible that we may get funds through this. So the legislature is aware of that and has approved that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rummel, did you have a question? Okay. All right, please move on. We're up to page 6.
Madam Chair, just one other thing to point out on R6 is that 344, 345, it does reference electric appliance replacements, and MHFA programs do not fund electric appliance replacements that are not fixed assets of the dwelling.
Where are we? Electric appliance replacements. Those cannot be funded with this loan program?
Not through MHFA's loan program, so.
Okay. And that's because they have a rule on that, or they have a law on that, or you can't use this to replace your refrigerator? Or
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on electric appliances, our fix-up fund loans currently are you, if this is done through the loan product, and if we're administering grants, it would be likely different, but it wouldn't be an existing program. So if you use the House language, you might need to change that word existing. But the current language under statute for the home improvement loan is that it's part of the real property that's attached and can't be removed from the property.
Okay.
So an appliance would not be eligible under our current loan program.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prentice-Olin.
They'd still be eligible for those rebates,
yes.
though, and maybe information could be provided by MHFA regarding
yeah.
that.
Yeah, well, if they're already, I'm not sure how they're going to connect up with MHFA, but if they come via a lot of these different entry points, like through commerce or through some kind of a local organization that's promoting these, then they would offer those other options for rebates. And commerce will have some appliance rebates. The utilities will have some appliance rebates.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Keeley.
I think Senator Prentice-Olin's question goes to language we might want to think about including or work out with the department that that the House language was really intended to give as much flexibility but maintain the sort of center of that hub at OES so that they are coordinating and providing,
sure.
and for your bingo card, the one-stop shop so that really it's all easy for homeowners to access the federal tax credit, the MHFA loan option, if it may be there, the SIP rebates, et cetera. So there's a package.
Sure.
So, and so I just hope that perhaps OES might have some language to add that'll clarify that relationship or that role.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, we can certainly work on that.
Thank you.
Yes, we do. On page R7, the best value bidder language on 430 to 432. I think, Madam Chair, if we can provide language that says to the extent allowable by federal law, that would allow us to make sure that we're not running afoul of any issues while still trying to affect the intent. I would say that there may be, I've talked with Lynn Hinkle at length about perhaps some different language that may more accurately focus the intent of trying to provide more market opportunity to those products that have a greater direct, indirect, and induced economic value to Minnesota. And there, if we can craft some language in the next few hours, then that we might offer that as a replacement.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
This might be a question for Director Glahn. You know, we've heard when we do Minnesota preferences, a concern about retaliation or about state-to-state trade wars. And I think it's a real legitimate concern, especially since Marvin Anderson, you know, when we look at our window folks, that they do a lot of exporting. And I just wonder if you've had a chance to speak with the governor's office or others about any concern along those lines. I appreciate it. We're on the same page that, you know, we want these dollars to circulate all multiple times in Minnesota and for our folks to benefit. I just wonder if you've had a chance to hear from
Mr. Glahn.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I have not had a discussion with the governor's office on this specific point in this bill. I mean, I think I've had general conversations with the governor's office on the on the general subject of the Interstate Commerce Clause and state preferences, and I just characterize those conversations as not wanting to do anything that jeopardizes our position here in the state. That being said, I can tell you from my interactions with the governor is a very strong supporter of Minnesota business and Minnesota-made products and takes every opportunity he can to promote the hometown team. But I think your point is well taken that I believe our products can compete with anybody in the world. So I'm not particularly concerned with these sort of provisions because I think we're going to win out anyway. That Minnesota consumers are exercising their free will that Mr. DeFebri mentioned earlier would want to support the local products as well. You know, the Pella, Iowa is famous for making windows too. So, you know, I can conceive of situations where other states wouldn't be so happy with this sort of situation. And not the governor's office, but in the course of this week, I have had other people express concerns, perhaps not about the window issue specifically, but about this issue of what happens if we do that. Will other folks use that as an excuse to go and blackball us? But I will have that discussion with the governor's office.
If you could, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, policy end of the discussion relative to that, the language here relative to the window replacements is within the residential programs. And, again, those are, you know, funds that are going to be funneled through MHFA down to individual homeowners who are then going to select contractors and select windows that they are going to install. We can certainly, within our contractual language, if you want, have a requirement for that. If you would like us to actually try to police that, we would need a few hundred more people.
That's okay. That's a good point. Thank you.
Madam Chair, to the location of this provision, I know that the window manufacturers in the state have been they're interested in the residential windows, but I think they believe that the quicker turnaround and benefit is in the industrial or the institutional piece. And so if it is something that we choose as a conference committee to include with a lot of careful crafting, if it's something, and we need to have that question, I think, answered by the governor's office in terms of the politics of it, that I would imagine we'd want it to apply to windows for our school buildings and state government buildings as well.
On page R7, the Innovative Residential Energy Efficiency Program, I think we had two comments. The first one concerns line 511 and 512. Again, the Weatherization Assistance Program is a very prescriptive program, parameters, rules, and so we just wanted to make note that the city of Duluth can't technically utilize those funds. We can coordinate with the weatherization program, and certainly if there are ways that we can work together, we are happy and willing to do that. But it's the city of Duluth is not a service provider.
Okay,
Senator
Prentner-Solon.
This allocation wasn't intended from the weatherization program, was it? It's from the state energy program.
I think Ms. Streff is just pointing to a really tiny word choice here. We can just change the wording, and I don't think there's a problem.
Weatherization?
No, that's just who they coordinate with.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would, if you even struck the weatherization program, it would be fine, and we would still definitely be willing to work with the program, and if there's weatherization assistance program funds that somehow come into it, they can be used there. But the other comment or thing I noted that it would be beneficial for us if it were added is that there is no requirement right here for these entities that are receiving the grant money to do any reporting. And if we could...
We do have, Ms. Streff, I was thinking we had some kind of reporting, but perhaps it could be spelled out more on the next page. Paragraph 6, measurement and assessment of program effectiveness and energy saving. So that was an important piece, but maybe you want something that comes back to you.
On a regular schedule so that we can make sure that you get it on the schedule that you've asked for as well.
That's a very good suggestion.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Kalin.
If OES could provide us not only with language for that, but as much as we can go to the expansion statewide, you know, expansion and without using the word research.
Yeah, well, this isn't a research project, but we could certainly make it eligible for other projects that meet these criteria. They're not research projects. They're projects that will save energy.
I understand.
We're just going to learn from them. You can learn from things that aren't researched.
Exactly.
Madam Chair, I know that their Representative Kaelin had raised some questions about revolving loan funds, and I would like to allay his concerns that revolving loan funds are eligible under SEP rule, and this use of them would fall within those what requirements they do have for those. Our previous conversations relative to revolving loan funds were related to different purposes and were about reservations about the need for or the effectiveness of revolving loan programs in some instances.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Glahn.
Before we move off the subject of this item, I want from a policy perspective, as opposed to the technical comments that my staff have made. I wanted to say a little bit about this. We've talked a lot about the flexibility. You know, our preference would be all else equal to have the ability to choose projects on an individual basis. And, you know, so we're going to have, rather repeat myself every time we come up to one of these items that specifies a specific state, or sorry, specific city within the state, or a specific utility service territory, or whatnot. I would just reiterate our preference for a plan that wouldn't have, at this point in time, the specificity of where we've designated a certain dollar amount of funds for use in a certain limited geographic area. That being said, I was just in Duluth on yesterday morning talking to the Chamber of Commerce, which I very much enjoy and appreciate the opportunity travel to the city by the lake and meet with the good folks there. And I appreciated the folks who were driving up and back in the same day since I did that in the same morning. That being said, I did hear the discussion we had earlier today about wanting to find a couple of examples, perhaps, of some innovative projects that stuff hasn't been tried before, and using them as examples of what can be done with the idea that down the road we will scale it up and roll it out to other parts of the state and perhaps other markets, depending on the success of it. So I did want to provide some support for the concept of having, whether we call it pilot projects or whatever we do, that I think that's a good thing to have. And just in my policy, reading through the provisions of this particular one, performance of measures, you know, it gets some the beyond the basics, the revolving loan funds we've already discussed, innovative financing options, measurement and saving. This all sounds great. The one thing I got hung up on, and I don't know how Representative McNamara feels about this particular item, but I think it's a point well taken that to the extent that we can direct funds to direct savings programs. And this is something that we've gone around and around about in SIP, to have the monies directed towards something that's going to have an immediate and direct and measurable savings of energy, rather than, and I'm referring to 5.21, 5.22, where we have a requirement for an environmental and carbon footprint awareness campaign. And the reason I apologize to Representative McNamara, because I recall his having the discussion with the witnesses from Duluth about whether there'd be admin cost or overhead cost included in the $1.5 million. And that was the question that I had about this particular program, not understanding that I understood there would be loans, but I didn't understand where the funds were going to come from to pay for the administrative cost that Representative McNamara. And my question was where the funds were going to come from for paying for the environmental and carbon footprint awareness campaign. And my preference would be, if we're going to designate specific dollar amounts for specific projects, that we do it in a way where we have direct energy savings that we can measure, as we have in point six on 533 and 534. So I have a concern with including this language on 521 and 522 about this awareness campaign, because I don't see the direct benefits to saving energy, which, as Mr. DeFebre discussed, is pretty much our number one priority to get that second 50% of the money.
Thank you for the clarification. All right, proceed.
Madam Chair, still on R8, 6.1 through 6.16, school district and local government renewable energy, a number of concerns. The level of appropriation in the Senate bill at $10 million seems to be a very large chunk of our SEP funding that may not be may not meet the minimum requirements for our return on investment, which is in aggregate 10 million BTUs per $1,000 invested. So we have some concern about the level of funding there. There's also some concern, and perhaps just a clarification. There's no language in here that specifies whether this is a partial grant, a 100% grant, and I guess my question is that left up to our discretion?
Well, in the statutory language for this program, we put maximum grant amounts.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've looked at that language.
It's
on page
further on. I think there was a concern about a limit for ground source heat pumps, geothermal. There wasn't one set, so, and that is further along. And we can address it at that point.
When we get there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Go ahead then.
Madam Chair, there was also discussion about the actually, I don't know whether it's today or in the stakeholder meeting yesterday, about the requirement to have a utility that's signing a PPA for 60 megawatts or greater than 60 megawatts to contact local government entities about partnering. And there are a number of issues with that, in particular that at this point, it's highly unlikely that a wind developer developing that site is going to voluntarily partner with a small entity. There's additional time and cost that would be involved in them doing that, and there is no requirement or incentive that we have in place that would compel or induce them to want to do that partnering. It's an approach. Co-development approach is something that I've worked on, thought about a whole lot over the past year and a half since the CBED task force, and it's a very enticing approach, but we haven't figured out how to make it work yet, and I think this may be a little premature.
Do you have your hand up, Mr. Eloff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say that the language also doesn't say whether if the school district or local government wants to partner that the utility has to do that. It just says
No. It's Mr. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to correct you, but I just want to be clear. Our intention was only to ask to tell the utilities to pick up the phone and call them. That's all. It was not intended to compel anybody to do anything beyond say hello so that there'd be an opportunity for them to know each other exists. That's all it is, because, yeah, it would be a lot more complicated if we started going beyond that. We're not trying to say you have to include a school district. We just want to open lines of communication. That was really the purpose of this.
My concern is largely that the contact from the utility might provide some false hopes to the school district or local government that at this point is probably not going to get a positive response out of a wind developer. That's my only concern.
Mr. Glenn.
Madam Chair, again, my recollection, this came up in yesterday's informal meeting, so none of that discussion is on the record. And I guess I don't know if this would be hearsay at this point, but I recall the description given by the utility of the timing issue. You know, notwithstanding Mr. DeFebvre's threshold issue of the effectiveness of the partnering, but it rang true for me in my past experience that by the time you get to the PPA, the deal is done, and then to go and bring in another party would be problematic and might introduce delay. And I only bring that up because. Sake of the record.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on.
All right. Page R9. This one? No, I get this one first. On the Senate side, line 618 to 622, we believe that this is one that that you have requested or required us to do a competitive grant for the block grant funds, and certainly that city could also access that, so we weren't quite sure that this was the best place for this to be.
And, Madam Chair, also on R9, on the House side, Article 3, Renewable Energy Grant Program, a few concerns related to this. It is a program intended to aid seabed projects with a maximum of a $500,000 grant. There are a couple of structural issues that, but instead of addressing those, I think there's a broader issue for us in that. In order for any of these projects to help us meet our performance requirements, they're going to have to be essentially developed prior to September 30 of next year.
Okay.
Any seabed project that is not viable without a grant from us is not going to be able to meet that timeline. Development is a long process. If they are viable, then we are giving them a grant for something that they don't that they don't need to be a viable project.
Is that true pretty much for any grant? If they need the grant, then they're not viable, and if they don't need it, they are.
The issue becomes the long development timeline for a seabed project.
Sure. That's Representative Baxter, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Representative Westrum's provision, and I'm just wondering. Representative Kalin and I did meet with him when we broke earlier, and he asked if you could visit with him. He had some ideas how he thought it might be workable. He did not want to lose any of the funding. He didn't want to lose the flexibility, but he had some ideas, and he wondered if you could visit with him maybe sometime over the next 24 hours.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
On page R10 on the House side, that's where I see it. I think it's also in the Senate, but I'm not quite sure where right now. 7.112 to 714. Basically, that a $2,500 grant is small in our view, that in the solar rebate program it was running an average of about $9,000. It was $2,000 a kilowatt, so we don't foresee that there would be many grants being awarded, as it wouldn't be enough of an incentive. So we would recommend that be changed.
Ms. Taraf, we did have, I mean, this, when it was originally introduced, I think it grew. It's one of those proposals that grew a lot. But the concept was about these little mini wind turbines that are $10,000 or $15,000, and then you could partner it with a federal tax credit, and it could be affordable. But mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. Thank you.
In the commercial and industrial energy efficiency, just a general comment is that as we've been hearing, as this has gone on and on, We've been hearing from a number of small businesses and also utilities, who we certainly work with a lot in our SIP program, there seems to be a lot of opportunity right now for some energy efficiency opportunities in small businesses or smaller programs that utilities have. They are reaching out already. I think Representative McNamara had asked about commercial industrial opportunities through the SIP program, and certainly there are many. However, even in our SIP program, one of the areas that we have found has not been reached to its fullest extent by the utilities at this point are small businesses. And so they're looking at that, and we would we think the language pretty much works, but we would certainly recommend that the amount could be higher in the commercial industrial area. We think that there's opportunity for energy efficiency savings that could happen quite quickly. It would benefit small businesses and therefore families, so that is the main recommendation that we saw there, unless Mr. DeFebri sees something. Director Guan.
Madam Chair, just to emphasize what Ms. Streff was saying, that you know we put a plan in front of you before we had gotten the guidance and try to do something quickly as possible to have a straw man or whatever the cliche would be, but I would echo Ms. Streff's experience that as I go around, there's a lot of demand out there for monies in this area to either reopen shuttered facilities and put people back to work, or to make facilities that remain open more competitive, not just with their competitors around the country, but worldwide. So when I would ask you to consider the thought that when you're comparing the two ideas, the house and this house version that is more of a grant program, and the Senate version, which is more of the loan approach, that you don't think of it as either or, that if you could find a way and find funds to do the both and. Because I think they both have their place and they both have value, and we think the Port Authority has come up with I spoke favorably of this idea of the experimentation, trying to find some models that work. And I think this is an idea worth trying. We also think the more traditional, making grants for items, and I appreciated the discussion from Xcel Energy about we recognize and our office recognizes the need for and the difficulty of penetrating that residential market. But we would also like to see sufficient resources to do something in the commercial, industrial. I don't even get hung up on that technology. Let's just call it the non-residential market, because I don't want to leave out nonprofits and schools and everybody else. So the non-residential market, there's still a lot of good opportunities to find energy savings and to create or retain jobs. So I'd consider, rather than try to fight it out for one or the other, if you could see some way of retaining both. But we're going to have some specific questions about the provisions here, but I did want to make that overall point.
Madam Chair, on page R12, line 8.15 on Senate language, the Port Authority and Xcel have already addressed this. We would agree with them that the language does, for this specific program, provide a restriction that is not necessarily provided broadly in SIP, and it would likely cause an issue with actually implementing the program, and we believe it's a valuable program to look at. So,
Madam Chair and members, before we move on, I did want to go and just revisit very briefly the discussion we had on page R11 concerning the Senate language and who is eligible for this. And I applaud the Port Authority for bringing this forward, but I want to make sure that everybody is under the understanding. I think Representative Hilty had some questions in this area. Are other entities eligible to apply for this, and the companion issue, are customers outside of Xcel service territory eligible to participate in the program? And we would like to see the Port Authority participate in it. We'd like to see the ability of people throughout the state participate in it.
And I think that's what this language allows. That's certainly our intention.
I would just tell the members that that's how I read it, right. And if my own devices, how I would implement it.
Very good.
Madam Chair, R13, 56.1.14, 56.17, definition of renewable energy systems. Certainly in the stakeholders meeting, there was discussion of this. I think it is unlikely that the intent was to restrict strictly to solar thermal water heating. I don't know that a trying to incent emerging industries, whether you need to actually have a megawatt nameplate capacity applied to that. I think any size wind energy conversion system that we can foster the manufacturing of in the state would
yes.
be useful.
I think that we agree with you on that. That sort of shouldn't be in there.
And Madam Chair, to the general issue of the definitions of what qualifies and what doesn't qualify, I believe our preference would be to be as inclusive as possible. That again, we don't sit here knowing what the best ideas are, and somebody could say, well, that's not really competitive today, and then some inventor comes out with something 6 months from now that's the hot new thing in energy. So I'd like to, when you're considering writing your definitions, to try to cover everything everything under the sun. That was probably.
Do you have any specific? Do you want me to write everything under the sun, or do you have any
other? I thought about that. There have been many, and Madam Chair, I'm afraid all the easy jokes have been taken, so I don't think I have anything to contribute in that area. But as you're writing the definitions, could you? I would encourage you to err on the side of allowing more stuff in and not less.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind.
On page R14, I just wanted to respond to some of the discussion today very quickly. One of the staff that we intend to hire will be a person that will be working, coordinating with the utilities and the other programs and the SIP program so that, for instance, in this program, all of the outreach that they were talking about doing and the bill stuffers and how do we make sure that we're targeting the right people, that we intend to work with the utilities and connect them to the correct programs and try and facilitate that. So we have seen a need as well and do intend to put somebody on that coordination full time. And one other that it's a fun project, and everybody's been wondering how do we make people understand and how do we make people change their behavior. And in the SIP R&D program, we currently have several utilities doing an R&D program with a group called Positive Energy, which does analyze the data, utility bills and the people surrounding you, and then on a monthly basis the home gets a sheet of paper saying, did you know that this is how much energy you use, electricity, natural gas, and this is how you compare to your neighbor. And we've had quite a bit of response to that. People typically haven't known how they've done. A lot of them, some have said, I'd like to know who that person is who's using so much or so little. But then also there are opportunities for Home Depot, for instance, to put a coupon in there to go do something, and it's our intent to work with this pilot program once we understand what other programs we can access here to make sure that they can avail themselves of these programs even through this pilot program.
Yep.
Madam Chair, on this point specifically, I know we had a lot of discussion on this project earlier today, and we were fortunate to hear from the CERTS folks themselves, and I know you're aware, and you and Representative Hilty will both be aware that the office is very supportive of the work of CERTS, and we applaud their work and look forward to continuing to work with them for years to come. But my reaction is reading in following this provision as it's come about, and then hearing the discussion today and the good questions that were asked, there certainly is a need for community outreach. No doubt about that. That there are communities that need to be reached that aren't being reached today, and we're open to any good ideas out there to how to get it done. And we heard a lot of good discussion. It sounds like we were making some good progress in something that where the utilities were partnering with folks that would bring a lot of resources to bear on the issue. That being said, the specifics of the program that's in the statute, or sorry, in the Senate proposal today, I'd characterize it. There are a lot of good elements to it, but it doesn't seem to be a fully thought through plan. And my concern here was that what the work product would be. They were going to gather some data and produce some output, but what that work product would be, and would we receive it, and what kind of oversight this effort would have on a higher level. So I don't know how Representative Kalin feels about it, but from what I took from his comments on it, that we have efforts in the House bill to get at education and training and some of these other elements that perhaps under that umbrella we could put something together where we're targeting underserved communities and give us more general direction in how to do it, and then let us go and partner with CERTS, partner with the utilities, whoever can bring useful resources to bear and reaching that. So rather than getting so specific with the door-to-door, we talked about the effectiveness of that, or the time frame or who would do it, we're given more general direction about targeting underserved customers and or types of customers, and then let us go forth and do good in that area. So my thoughts were, from hearing the CERTS folks talk about the specifics of their idea, there were some good elements, but not a fully thought through A to Z proposal where I understood who is going to do what, who is going to get which, how much money, and what oversight and what follow through there would be at the end. So my general reaction, again, it's a lot of money, and we heard from Ms. Streff about some pilot projects, and I think that's what's needed. Let's experiment. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. But this is a lot of the money from one project for one project, one approach.
Madam Chair, still on R14, 928 to 930, just a technical point. The phrase subject to qualifications related to residential energy programs funded with federal stimulation money, I don't know what that means in the context of an individual giving consent to release private data.
Mr. DeFebre, Madam Chair, I think it's a sign of how long we've been sitting here that we should get try to finish the walkthrough as soon as we can here, because I don't know if there's federal stimulation money.
Probably not. Probably not.
That probably violates the rules of the
year. Although I have been saying that I've been overstimulated lately. That's... I still don't know what it means, even though I can't read it. That's
touché.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Oh.
Next.
On page R15, on the Senate side, line 20, 10.23, we would recommend striking the licensed electrical and just have by contractors in compliance. And I know this was discussed at the open meeting yesterday, but we did check with the Department of Building Codes and Standards, and the Minnesota Electrical Act does not preclude general contractors from mounting the panels as long as the electrical work is subbed out to licensed electricians. So I think that striking that allows a broader group to be doing it, who is allowed to do it.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Blunt.
Before we move off of this subject, my general reaction was it was a significant amount of money. I was pleased to see in the omnibus budget bill we were able to fund some more of those rebates that were highly successful that we sold out. We gave them all away. We'd have given away more had we had more funds for those solar rebates. So we certainly support solar, and we think the rebate model is something that has shown a lot of effectiveness in the past. But I'm concerned about the amount of money that is devoted to this particular line item. And point two, again, we support the central corridor concept and applaud NSP for coming through with a plan to do a lot of innovative and groundbreaking things with that effort. But again, I would point out the interaction of all these bills. We have provisions in the policy bill that would enable a lot of stuff to happen in terms of the central corridor. So I guess this is more of a question, you know, to what extent is this provision redundant to what we've put in the policy bill? I think it's a rhetorical question, Madam Chair.
Well, I think, Mr. Gallant, I guess the answer is it's going to cost a lot of money to put a large-scale solar demonstration project on the ground, and so it's going to need a lot of partners. And Xcel ratepayers are going to have to contribute, and city's going to have to contribute, and there'll be lots. And this would be the state participating. So it's going to take a lot of partners to really put together something of that scale, which we, again, is one of those big demonstration projects that should happen somewhere in the state to see how well it can work, and then hopefully it could be replicated.
Madam Chair, going to R-17, Representative Kalin did discuss modifying the numbers on 10.30 to reflect 60% instead of the 61.5, and on R-18, House language on the 10.11 to 10.14, if that would be an including but not limited to, because federal ECBG rules do allow other activities under ECBG. We would not at this point want to restrict it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DeFebre, I was wondering about on line 10.14, I know Ms. Streff had told me this some months ago about the federal guidelines allowing renewable energy devices deployed on public buildings. Somebody asked me today if in public buildings is okay.
Madam Chair, Mr. Eliff, that would be up to a federal determination of whether on and in are substantially the same, and I would not presume.
Well, you should note that the Senate language says used in public buildings, and I would say that's more ambiguous and might open the interpretation that it could be either or. And I don't know, is there some magic federal law that says we have to say on public buildings?
But Madam Chair, there is a federal statute governing the block grant, and I would say that if that was referred to, that might include then the whole sphere of what is allowed. So it is more than I think both of these actually outline. So maybe including but not limited to.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Kim.
I think the intent here is to renewable energy devices deployed for public buildings. So I just want, I don't want to wordsmith now, but just want to throw that out there, and we'll ask you to bring back language that will satisfy your concerns on this.
We will gladly do that.
Thank you.
Moving to R-18, where just the heading is, R-19, where the bulk of it is in Senate language relative to limitation on administrative costs. We do not have a difficulty with a 5% limitation on administrative costs. We do have issues with what this language defines as administrative costs, and both in the implementation of this program, but more broadly in our implementation of other federal programs, where a legislative definition of those activities which we often categorize as program delivery costs in federal programs are often based on a state's customary practice in categorizing costs between program delivery and administrative, as long as they're reasonable. If you were to provide a legislative language that tells us these are administrative costs, I don't think we would have a basis to continue to characterize them as program delivery costs, and that could significantly inhibit operation of other programs with federal funds.
So, Mr. DeFebre, if you could, have you provided us any preferred language on this? If you're willing to accept a 5% limit.
He likes the House language.
Yeah.
Well, it's the House language.
How would you word that 5% limit?
I would merely say a 5% limit on administrative costs incurred by the Office of Energy Security, and perhaps we should qualify that does not reach down particularly to the weatherization providers.
Yeah, perhaps the word directly in there would be of use, directly by the Office of Energy Security. You know, we're not going to spend $20 million on our stuff, but you know, that lots of money will flow through us to others.
Okay. And so the list of administrative costs that are included here, that's problematic.
Yes, Madam Chair, it is problematic.
On page R20, on the Senate side, we noticed that there is no definition for school district, and it was, as we read through that language, it just went between local unit of government and school district, and it was confusing as to what got what kind of grants. So I think that we think that just adding a definition for school district would help. And then it's on, I'm not sure which side it is, but 1416, under subdivision 5, just ensure that both school districts and local governments are included throughout so that you're not just giving a grant to a local unit of government but also to the school district. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I don't think we need to talk anymore about the Minnesota product preference. I think there's been more than adequate discussion on that.
However, in Subdivision 8, that was where we had noticed that there was no stipulation of a maximum of amount for geothermal energy, and there was for others. So it was just a bit confusing, is all.
Okay. Do you have a suggestion?
We need to find out where the gen set.
Yeah, we
do. No, but we can certainly provide you with one.
Sure, if you think that would be useful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, on R22 language on both sides, on the Senate side 15.14 beginning, and on the House side 3.22 beginning. The language right now would restrict us to using stimulus funds in public sector, I believe, solely in conjunction with PBEEP. And we would like some flexibility for a couple of reasons. One is that PBEEP is not launched yet, and we would like to hit the ground with some shovel-ready products in the near future. But also there are some local government or entities that may not be necessarily qualified for PBEEP that still may be reasonably qualified for stimulus funds.
Okay. Do you have any? I can't remember who testified about the 25% of total project cost. Is that an issue?
Madam Chair, I don't remember who it was either, but they did.
Maybe
they
that
did,
was in the residential side.
I believe they did mention my concern is that if we do specify a grant amount and we try to match the amount of grant incentive to what the return on the investment is going to be, if you say 25, I have to give everybody 25, otherwise I have a lot of people angry at me. If you just designate cost share requirement, then it gives us some flexibility to scale the incentive to the specific projects.
Don't we have a 25% limit for the residential, for that loan and 35. Rebate program? Yeah,
35.
Mm-hmm. Those mini wind projects.
Madam Chair, I believe we might have on the residential side. Because we're not going to be working with say an individual school district or an individual local government with a package of measures more closely. The residential ones is we need. It's not an issue having a defined incentive. The issue might be if we find that 25% isn't getting the demand that we need. That do we want to have the flexibility to go to 35%?
Madam Chair?
Representative Kalin.
I'll just point out that we did have a 40% cap originally, and hearing from Mr. DeFebre's concern about everybody going to 40. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your concern about not having some cap or some constraints. I think this may go to our legislative review section that's very early in the House bill perhaps have a chance to, and I'm not actually asking this out of posture, merely to find a way to continue to have the collaboration and the back and forth so that we understand if a decision is made otherwise that you've exhausted all other options. Or that even more so that you're stretching the dollar as far as it possibly can go.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, it's certainly our intent is to stretch the dollar as far as to leverage as much as we can. However, in some of these areas, in the particular economic situation we're in, we are not sure what the workable incentive level is going to be, and that's the concern with some of those defined numbers. It may need to be higher in some areas. It may functionally work very fine lower at a different one. So it's if you give us a specified one, we will work with a specified one. But it does present programmatic issues then.
Okay. I remember we had a lot of conversation about this in the policy committee, and I guess we're sort of rewriting everything. Listening.
Is that all you need?
It's too bad we didn't have this information way back then, but it's okay. I know everybody's scrambling to figure this out.
Madam Chair, on R23 on Senate side, you do specify on a appliance. Apparently we're going to back up here.
Madam Chair, on. Under the state government building renovations section 6, there is the Minnesota statute section 16B.32 should be actually 16B.322.
Okay.
322.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, then on to R23, the Senate language section 7, appliance replacement, program to supplement and enhance rebates. We are going to be getting approximately $5 million from the stimulus for that program, but you are not appropriating that money to us in this bill. So it might present us with some difficulties in implementing it.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeFebri, is that is the message butt out, or please appropriate?
Well, we do not have a specified amount. If you can appropriate all funds, on an all funds made available to us, then certainly that would work. But I don't know whether that kind of language works on within your rules.
Well, we have that other statute in place that we referenced. It will come up in a couple of pages. On the top of R25 about Minnesota statutes 3.3005, and I'm not quite sure what we need to. What language we need to have in place to authorize spending of other grants that come in when we're not in the legislative session, or when we. So,
Madam
I think our
Chair.
Council can figure that out.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I hope that we can figure that out tonight or tomorrow, and determine what we need to do with this. We'll have to get some more guidance on that.
Madam Chair, we can submit the amount when we know if you are not in session through the LAC.
Yeah.
And so, Madam Chair, if it's any time after, say, October, we probably won't be in session, and so we'll take care of it then.
You're optimistic.
Maybe.
Ooh, wow.
So we don't know that we need this language or not. So.
No. And Madam Chair, language. Representative Kaling, we may still be presenting then.
Time will stand still.
Do you want to do the
Certainly. On page R23, first on the Senate side, under subdivision 2, we would strike "and certification," since we do not certify energy managers or building operators or auditors. And then on the House side, 4.20, we understand that there is great interest in having DEED be the lead. However, we do feel a great responsibility to our federal programs that require us to provide training for weatherization. It is ultimately our responsibility, and so I would ask that the Office of Energy Security is first in consultation with DEED and the Office of Higher Education. I will say, however, that since language has appeared, we have been working diligently to bring all of the resources together and to figure out the scope of training, short-term, long-term, that's needed, curriculum that's needed for commercial recommissioning, ag audits. It is an opportunity and has been an opportunity for us to finally put our arms around everything that we know we need to have in the state to make sure that we're getting people trained to do the green jobs, the renewable energy technicians. It's been invigorating. So we are working together, and, if it doesn't, certainly, we'll certainly work in consultation with them. But if it could be changed, that would be great.
Oh, Representative Champion.
Just a quick question. I think earlier you were talking about how it's important to be flexible. Would this also be one of those areas? Because I was wondering, should the committee at least think about how many training dollars will be made available, and whether there should be some notion around how many of those dollars will be made available to train actually people who are going to be working in homes or public buildings, and finally will that help us to ensure that a fair portion of those funds will be directed specifically at low-income workers or people who might not have an ability to pay for training. So I know that's three questions, but I'm sure that you got it all.
Madam Chair, Representative, and I can ask again, definitely. We do have training in several areas, and the weatherization program allows us to spend up to 20% on training and technical assistance. That's a lot of money, more than we anticipate needing. In fact, when we don't use it for training and technical assistance, we then can transfer it into program, and it does more homes. So it's really something that we want to try very hard to do as efficiently as possible. The weatherization training and technical assistance dollars are truly meant to be used to train folks to have the skills that they need to do low-income weatherization. And in fact, my supervisor isn't here, but she just gave me from the WAP funding announcement, they were reminded that grantees and subgrantees should secure a retention agreement in exchange for training, which we had not been aware of. So we are still working to see what we can spend on training for others, whether they will all go into weatherization, low-income weatherization activities, whether we train them for that, and they ultimately do some other residential weatherization. We are still attempting to find our way around that, but it isn't just a simple matter of saying X amount for scholarships for low-income people to be trained in that. It really is to be trained to make the weatherization assistance program go further. That said, I know somebody mentioned the Dunwoody course being $770 for the 40-hour course. I know that Summit Academies is $770, so it seems to be the going rate. $5,400 for their 20-week course, which we met with Summit last week, and it really seems like a good, solid course that we should be supporting here. So we're trying to find our way as to where can we spend what dollars for what. We cannot spend weatherization dollars for commercial or renewable energy kinds of training curriculum development. So we need to find other dollars to do that as well.
So would it help, Madam
Champion?
So would it help to specify or not? I think I'm hearing you say remain as flexible as possible. The only thing I'm a little concerned about, and I hope the committee would think about this, is that I hear you talking about training individuals for low-income weatherization, and I believe that to be important. But I want to balance that also with training low-income people to do low-income weatherization. And so I hope that's a consideration or something that you all would think about or perhaps advise us how to best craft language, if they so choose, that would help make sure that we are balancing those two important interests.
Madam Chair, Representative, certainly we want to train people for low-income weatherization and low-income people for low-income weatherization and low-income people for commercial weatherization.
Absolutely.
And recommissioning. So I think we have to figure out how do we do the outreach, but where do we get the funding, and then how do we support the institutions with a certain amount of funding to help defray costs? We have not figured that out. As far as directing us to do something with the weatherization assistance program dollars, that is a highly prescriptive federal program, and it's got a lot of rules, and in fact the rule where we should encourage the grantees and subgrantees to have a retention agreement is from one of those. So I don't know that having language in the bill would help us at this point, because we will need to follow the weatherization assistance program.
Mr. Glenn.
Madam Chair, that being said, to follow up with the representative's question, I hate up to bring up the tawdry topic of COIN, but in our draft plan, we had included, is it $5 million of the state energy plan for these efforts. And the House had, according to the spreadsheet, included similar amounts. And we can have a discussion about how specific you are in the training and education, but I want to make it sure that it's clear that we have authority to spend dollars on those efforts. And the same thing with the administrative cost. We had a discussion about the specificity and limits on how much we can spend. I just want to make it clear that we have the authority to spend those dollars, even though there might not be a specific dollar amount line item on that.
Okay. Well, if you need specific authorization, I think I heard you say that, Mr. Golan. Then let us know what that should look like.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, let's see if we can get through the home stretch in just a couple more minutes. That would be really great.
Madam Chair, while they're searching for their last comments, just in the interest of completeness and along the lines I mentioned earlier about that one issue, back on R15, I neglected to mention this when I was having a discussion about the solar program. The Senate side, there's language 10.15 through 10.28. It's our belief that that the 10.15 to 10.17 doesn't create any conflicts with the federal requirements, but I think that's something we want to double check. And then we heard discussion yesterday on the informal meeting about discussions between contractors and tradespeople. About perhaps some changes to that language there. I guess we're not picking sides there. I don't recall us picking any sides there, but would just encourage members to give us language that everybody's in agreement on and outside of the room here. Sorry.
Okay, sounds good.
And perhaps not err on the side of not creating any barriers. And my final thought was not wanting to get in the middle of the background check issue. We told you what the Office of Energy Security thinks about the issue, but I heard the discussion between Senator Dill and Representative McNamara that there was going to be a commitment to go back to the amendment's authors and to work something out, and I think we would like to see that happen.
And Madam Chair, one final point on R25. Both sides on Senate side, 18.16, 18.17. On House side, 5.27, 5.28. I think we should restrict the information related to location, building owner, to the non-residential programs.
Okay. That's a good point. All right. Anything else? Is that it?
I would just give you one more piece of information from the conversations that we've had today. And the testimony is you were talking about the competitive funds and how are we working to get as much as we can into the state. And I want you to know that we are already working with the Department of Administration to get with their grants group to get a PowerPoint on grant writing ideas, since not all grants will be through our office, but we want to make sure that they understand what's the best way to write a grant. We also are sending out regular funding opportunities notices. We're checking FedConnect and grants.gov to make sure that we're on top of it. So we're trying to set the stage so that we can get everybody prepared to apply for as many as they can.
Excellent. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that completes our introductory remarks.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Kalin.
Madam Chair, knowing the sun is low and the hour is late, just a couple of questions, two specific and then a third larger one. The first one is discussion on prevailing wage and the our volunteers. It's volunteer labor, like for instance in the outreach. Is that allowable just under the ARRA and prevailing wage requirements? Or should we watch out for that language?
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, the Department of Energy has been very slow in giving us final guidance on exactly how the SEP work interfaces with Davis-Bacon. Davis-Bacon really is construction projects and mechanical, and then other projects, says ERA. So we have been asking them questions. We have not received the final answers at all.
Well, I would assume it's voluntary to pay volunteers.
I would think so.
Wage.
Yeah.
Second question, Madam Chair, is would you be comfortable if we added on the reporting requirements, the your admin expenses in relationship to the 5% cap and however we deal with that issue overall? Just want to make sure under the transparency and accountability section that you'd be comfortable doing that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, I see no problem with that. I would presume we're going to be having to push that up into federal reporting anyways.
Okay. And thank you. And then, Madam Chair, the last question I have is actually on the spreadsheet. There's a significant difference, I think, on the you've commented some on the heavy emphasis in the Senate bill on the renewables. And I think that the largest difference really is between, if you shift money over, it's really on the public building renovation, where the Commerce made the largest of the three positions, the three numbers. Can you just articulate a little bit about why you chose to do that in your offer, and if your emphasis there still stands, or in your proposal, excuse me, in your offer?
Well, while you're thinking about that, perhaps we've had some conversation about the commercial industrial piece, too, and maybe you could kind of update us on what your thinking is for that number as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, our numbers have been high on the buildings part because we believe we can get the most energy savings the quickest. We think those projects are ready. And it will allow us to reach the goal that DOE has set for us of the 10 million BTUs per $1,000 spent more quickly. That may also allow us to, if other states haven't reached that goal either as soon or ultimately, it would allow us to perhaps get even some of that funding. We don't know if that is correct or not, but that opportunity supposedly exists. And so that's really why we have expressed caution about how we put these programs together, and you know, how long is something going to take to get off the ground, how many energy savings or how much renewable energy is generated. That certainly is a good thing. Also, how many jobs are created and retained. So I think even as we move forward, those will all be elements that are going to be requirements as to who is the most successful in getting the funds. Do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, to Representative Kalin, in terms of the numbers, I would not do not consider our numbers operative anymore. I mean, that was a plan we did some months ago, and upon reconsideration, and along the lines of my both and comments about your two industrial program, commercial non-residential programs, you know, if you were to add them two together, if you had something $10 million or something like that for the non-residential energy efficiency, it's 20% of the total. Doesn't seem to be an unreasonable amount, given how effective everybody agrees these programs are.
Great.
And then, Madam Chair, one last question. And that is, Director Glahn, we've been working extremely well together, the department and certainly the House, and I think that constructive conversations in the Senate. And so obviously I want to thank you for your help and your work, but I also want to be sure that when we wrap our work and hopefully have 10 signatures on the conference committee report tomorrow night, that we can be assured that the governor will sign the bill. And so I hope, Director Glahn, that we can hear explicitly from you and that you are the one that we should be making sure and clearing all provisions with so that we can get that signature. Is that right? You're the one?
Mr. Black.
Madam Chair, Representative Kalin, the short answer to your question is yes, and to Representative Hilty, I promise to be much more direct in my answer tomorrow than I was over the weekend.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that answer tomorrow. All right. Thank you very much for your time. And members, thank you very much for your attention. This has been a long day of meetings, but we've covered a lot of ground. So I think it puts us in a good position to try to sit down. I mean, I feel like I could sit down and write my new version of the bill, what I would recommend. I don't know if everybody would agree with it, but I think we could all do that. Why not? Representative Kalin's going to chair tomorrow. What time are you thinking?
Madam Chair, we'll be meeting in this room at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning sharp, house time. And I understand that.
I recall we were here first this morning.
Madam Chair, I was the first legislator in the room, as far as I know.
Well, when I got here, my staff said your side of the table wasn't even started yet. Okay.
Madam Chair, we'll be starting at 10 a.m. sharp.
Sounds good.
And
right. We'll race to be the first.
I do understand we'll be doing, the House will be convening at 9:30 for pledge, prayer, and recess for caucus. I understand the Senate will be going in at noon, so we will try to make two very productive hours of work. And then we'll have to recess for the deliberative bodies and then come back as soon as we possibly can. And let's hope within 26 hours of this clock that we'll have some signatures on the conference committee report, or at least an agreement and direction to staff to prepare it.
All right. If there's no further questions, the meeting's adjourned. Yeah, well. Maybe philosophically speaking, conceptually speaking, what do you call it?